Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we take a look at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, works out of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. And if you have a question for him about an insect you may have seen, or maybe you want to, there's something you want to get rid of, or maybe it's just something you're curious about, I hope you'll join us. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. And please post a photo or a question about insects on my Facebook page. We'd love to see that as well. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show for that. And Phil, welcome back.
Nice to be back.
And, you know, I hadn't thought about this Christmas tree business, but when you bring in the Christmas tree, it's possible you're also bringing in some insects, eh?
Yeah, it doesn't happen very often. First of all, there's an urban rumor about deer ticks coming in with Christmas trees, and we just don't see that. I mean, that's not the habitat they would want to be in, so people shouldn't worry about that. But every once in a while, I either get aphids or a critter that we call bark lice or sosids off of it, and they're you know, little gnatty-like creatures, and they really don't do very well indoors, but the numbers can catch people's attention. So it is possible, but as I said, the good news is that they don't harm anything. And, you know, if you have to, you spray them a little bit with soapy water. But most of the time, they kind of run their course very quickly.
Well, you know, in the lab, you get so many calls and questions and samples brought in. What do you see at this time of year most often?
Critters coming out of pet food, you know, bird seed and those kind of things are quite common. Unfortunately, the bed bug thing is just a constant, you know, and so that goes in. Well, we get interesting ones. I mean, I had an interesting one that had some potential health problems where an infant was given formula and we found some critters in there. Now, the good news is it really was not, you know, the parents were very concerned, and I can understand that with a young baby. But and then it also suggested that somewhere along the line, not so much the manufacturing, but in the storage of this product, that insects got the opportunity to infest it.
So. Mm. Well, I tell you what, Jim in Wausau has a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, Jim. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. This is a question I had hoped to get in a couple months ago, but here in Wausau, about October 10th, after our first freeze, I was cleaning up the garden and came across the stalk of dill with one of those yellow, green, and black striped caterpillars that I think come from the swallowtail butterfly.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't tell whether it was alive or not. It certainly wasn't moving, and I'm just curious as to whether it's an insect that got its timing mixed up or whether there was some possibility that it would later spin a chrysalis and survive the winter.
Yeah, it should have been close. And if it wasn't moving much and it still had not, you know, shrunk from desiccation, you know, a lot of times these caterpillars will have a day or two kind of prep time where they're inactive and they're kind of getting metabolically things in order. So it may have been just before it was going to make its chrysalis. And, you know, with as warm as the fall was, if it had that opportunity, it would be very successful, because that's how swallowtails do get through the winter here, is the chrysalis. And, you know, people who get these and think they're doing a favor by bringing them indoors really are not, because that will either, in some cases, we need a cold shock to get them to completely develop. In other cases, they will emerge so early that they won't be way out of sync. And so, you know, it's fine to take these and put them in the garage or another unheated place, in a protected place, to help them get through the winter. But again, don't bring them into a warm place if you get that opportunity.
Okay.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yep, thanks for calling. Andre in West Allis, hi to you.
Hello, yes.
What can we do for you?
Trying to find a way to get rid of bed bugs. We tried heat treatment. We tried spraying every 1 to 2 weeks professionally. Just not going away.
Well, you know, if done correctly, there's no way that they can get around the heat treatments. I mean, the problem with chemicals is we've got some resistance problems, and so even if you think you've got every place and you do treat every place, they are. So a lot of times it's kind of trying to walk this back and try to think. In some cases, the problems have not been so much not eliminating them, but there are situations where they're getting reintroduced. In other cases, we find there are some building designs where you can't get the heat quite to where you want to unless you understand. You know, concrete buildings are, in some cases, are such heat sinks that, you know, people have been forced to use insulating things like styrofoam or other things on the wall so that they can make sure that they get the heat up to where they want. I think it's well worth talking with the company that provided the service.
Okay.
And talk about where they think things had fallen through the slats here, because, as I said, if you can get the temperature up to that 112, 114 degrees where the bed bugs are, there's no way they can survive that.
Okay.
You know, so it's not a resistance factor. So, as I said, there's something else that's not completing the picture here. And as I said, the reintroduction thing, you know, somebody taking a book bag out of a scenario and go to visit, stay with some friends, come back 2 days later and they reintroduce the bed bugs. I mean, that's unfortunately what happens. So you've went through all this expense and done everything right. And again, you find that,
about $1,500.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. You can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. Please give us a call. Paulette in Grays Lake, Illinois, up next. Hi, Paulette.
Hello. Good morning.
Morning.
I'm curious about a small flying insect that comes into our house in the fall and into the winter, and I'm still seeing, you know, one or two of them around the house. It's not a house fly. It's a very tiny black insect, and it has kind of wide wings, and it just alights on the wall, and they're pretty small, and they're not very fast moving, and they only, you know, we've been in this house 15 years, and they just seem to come in, you know, as it, late fall and early winter, and I'm wondering what it could be.
Well, there's more than one possibility. The first thing that comes to mind is, in the fall, there's a critter called a hackberry psyllid, and that's a little insect that lives in the leaves of hackberry trees, and it comes out of the leaves and will get into homes. But typically, once we get into the moderately cold weather, you kind of see the activity stop. The other thing that's very characteristic is you see them kind of piled up on the windowsills. To be honest, your comment about slow moving and sitting on the walls suggests to me something that we would call a drain or moth fly. And it'd be worth looking that up, you know, an image of that on the internet. They are kind of fuzzy, which is kind of interesting. It has to do with the way their wings are structured. And as the name implies, we see these in floor drains or sometimes bathroom overflow cuts that don't get a lot of water but stay damp and have organic matter. And they literally breed in that scenario, and then the flies come out, and they can show up all over the place, and so it gets quite confusing of where the source is. And I'm kind of leaning that way. I mean, do you see like two or three a day, or do you see 20 a day?
No, just a couple. And it's very interesting that you say that, because my husband was talking to somebody, and they said and suggested that maybe they were coming out of a drain of a bathtub in the house that we don't use. We have three bathrooms in the house, and there's a tub that we just don't ever use.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would fit. So, you know, what I would suggest here, don't use bleach. That doesn't really get you where you want to go, but get a really hot pail of water, or, you know, put the tea kettle on, pour that down and see if it solves it. But the other place to be careful of here, again, is in the bathtub, there's often an overflow cut. You know, there's a little, and sometimes what we have to do is get in there with a brush and clean it out, or get in there with a plunger, so that you basically, again, kind of flush this kind of slimy goop that has built up, because that's really where the maggots are found.
Yeah.
But not something you spray for. As I said, you find the source, you get it cleaned up, and life should be good.
So just put some boiling water down.
Yeah, real hot water down the drain. That would suffice there. The trouble with these overflow cuts is it's often their position that you can't get the water into them, because, you know, you can't pour upwards. And, like, that's where, again, if there is a small cut there, is get a small brush up in there, see if you get kind of some black slimy material. You may even find the maggots. I mean, it's interesting, because one of the samples I see is the maggots look very similar to mosquito larvae. And sometimes people are, you know, putting water in the sink in the bathroom, and they see these critters flying, they think they came out of the water, and the larvae basically flushed out either from the drain or the overflow cut. So,
okay, well, I'm not sure what an overflow cut is, so I'll just write that down.
Think in your bathroom sink, you often have a little small opening that, in case the water got too high, it would drain down the opening rather than flood. You don't see it so much in kitchen sinks, but it's quite common in bathroom sinks. Also in tubs. There's often right underneath the piece that opens and shuts the drain, there's a little cut underneath for the same reason. If the water gets too high, it would lessen the chance of flooding.
There you go. Thank you for calling.
Very good. Thank you so much.
And Wendy in Wausau, we are going to you next. Hi, Wendy.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question. I'm like a real organic kind of person, and my boyfriend is like kill everything, you know, with
Roundup, whatever, and we're considering possibly, you know, marrying and living together, and he sprays pesticides. He has a company come, and they spray everything every 3 months. And, you know, I've seen that a lot of these chemicals have not been tested on humans. There's a lot of reports that show that they can be linked to Parkinson's disease and brain tumors in children. And I don't want to live in a house that has all these chemicals in it because I believe they're kind of toxic. And I wonder if it's overstated to have to overkill and spray all this stuff all the time. I've never seen any pests in this house ever.
Well,
so,
you know, I mean, some of this is a personal decision, but, you know, the way I look at it, you know, if you lived in Florida, the potential of cockroaches and all kinds of other little critters coming in is so high that I understand a normal maintenance type of treatment. I guess the philosophy that I run under in Wisconsin is if you got a problem, you treat it and get it done. And this kind of preventative, proactive approach really is hard to justify. Now, you know, these chemicals are regulated. There are, you know, if used correctly, should pose very little risk. But the other side of it is why expose yourself if you don't have to? And so, I'm not a proponent of monthly services or three-month services. There's some homes that just have a constant problem, and every spring something shows up. And so to have an annual treatment for something like that is reasonable. But as I said, I go back to the point is if you've got a problem, it needs to be solved and finished. And this coming back once every 3 months is not the way we solve most of these problems. So I guess I'm more in the middle. You know, if you have problems, you address it. Maybe pesticides are one of the things you have to use. But as a preventative treatment, no.
These have never been tested on humans, though. These chemicals that are being used, there's no testing on humans.
Well, but a lot of it's been done on rats and mice, and if there's some real strong, you know, part of this is an exposure issue, you know. And if a chemical is sprayed behind a baseboard and whatnot and dries, it does not move. And so there's very little exposure there. And so I said you really have to look quite deeply into what are the factors involved. And sometimes I find people overly simplify it. It's true that you don't test these, although interesting enough and unfortunately enough, we do have human data, not so much from the United States, but in some countries, pesticides are used for committing suicide, you know, and in general, what we've seen, at least in my career, is the chemicals we're using indoors have less toxicity to people now than the chemicals that were used 30 years ago. I still will tell you that they do have toxicity issues. You know, you have to think if something's a nerve poison that affects an insect, it's really not far-fetched to believe that it has biological activity in people. The dose is different. As I said, we try to as much cut down on exposure. And a lot of these products, when they dry, don't go anywhere. So that's one of the reasons, if you read labels very carefully, it will say don't let people back in the room until it dries, because that really lessens the chance of you picking up some of these chemicals.
So if there's an issue with the insects in your house, there's some sort of infestation, you deal with it, you get it over with,
right.
And then you...
Right. As I said, it's hard to justify this preventive. In fact, this philosophically, it's the exact opposite direction. This is what we used to do 30 years ago. Once a month, we'll come in and spray everything in sight so you won't have critter problems. But again, you find that in Wisconsin, you know, probably 85% of the time you're treating when you don't need to. So that's a needless exposure that we've got.
Yeah.
And for some
and
problems...
needless expense.
Yeah. And for some problems, to be honest, the spray is not the answer. There are more direct methods of dealing with it that pest control companies can help you work through. So
there you go. Good luck, Wendy. Thank you for calling. I want to go to Joey in Downers Grove next. Hi, Joey.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Basic question about houseplants. I have a few houseplants around, and I'm just curious. I know I just tend to water, and a lot of them are large plants, so I'm not looking in the soil too much, and I know there's probably a few things crawling around in there, but I noticed one particular plant has like tiny, tiny white little, almost like, I don't want to say flea-like, but they're just white little tiny bugs, and is that like a normal thing for soil?
Well, yeah. I mean, the critters are probably springtails, and springtails are very common in organic matter soil, and so you probably have some organic component in your potting mix. They don't pose any problem to the plant at all. They don't bite. They don't do anything. I mean, some people don't like the idea of critters in their house, but...
Right. I don't see them anywhere else. I mean, they don't get out of the plant, and I tell my girlfriend that. She's like, oh, no, and I'm like, they don't do anything. They're just in there. And I think, well, maybe they're just good for the soil, and that's just what they do. So
yeah, I mean, there's a couple parts to it. Is one, in a lot of non-organic potting mixes, they wouldn't be able to do very well. But what happens is when dead plant leaves fall and whatnot, that adds the organic matter to the system. So you can make the argument they are a contaminant, but they're a harmless contaminant. And the argument, honestly, is that the treatments that are often suggested pose far more risk to the plants because they might prune the roots or cause other injuries. And so, as I said, normally... once you understand that, I mean, you don't want to add organic matter to the soil because that will enhance things for them. Some people will try to lessen their watering a little bit, but of course that gets fine edge because if you give too little water, the plant's going to be under stress.
Sure.
But I wouldn't worry about it. There are treatments if you really have to, but as I said, considering that they're harmless, I think most of the time they're best just left alone.
Great. Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have an insect question or comment, I hope you'll call us at 1-800-642-1234 or go to our Facebook page. Maybe you've got a photograph, an insect photograph you want to share with us or ask about the particular insect. You can do that as well. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and you can post there. And Phil, we actually, Phil King, sent us on the Facebook page a great photo of a honeybee, and his comment is, I believe an aeronautical engineer would tell you this aircraft, in quotes, cannot possibly become airborne carrying its present load.
And what you see on the picture, if you look on the legs, are these orange spherical structures, which are basically collected pollen. There's a structure called a pollen basket on a bee where they collect the pollen. And, of course, that's adding weight. And you see once in a while both bumblebees and honeybees that are so loaded up with pollen that they're kind of struggling. But it is quite amazing how well they're adapted and the like. And you know, the one thing you can see here, it's got kind of orange pollen. The flower it's next to is kind of yellow. And so my guess is the source of the pollen is a different plant than where we see this bee right now.
Oh, well, it's a beautiful photo. Go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show and take a look at it. Jim in Waukesha, it's your turn. Hi, Jim. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. We've lived in the same house here for 25 years, and this is the first year that we noticed sitting in our living room. Once in a while, we'll see what looks like a fruit fly, and there, you know, there's no fruit in the living room. It's all in the kitchen, and there's no activity around the fruit. So we're just wondering what they are. There aren't a whole lot of them, but it's, you know, like I say, the first time I've ever seen these.
Well, one of the ways you can tell, there are a handful of small flies you get indoors, but fruit flies, I will tell you, probably is the most common one I see. The adults can be found in a lot of places, just kind of cruising around. One of the giveaways, if they seem to be attracted to wine, beer, bread, anything that is yeasty, and that really is the secret to the control of fruit flies, is that the maggot stage isn't so much a feeder on ripe fruit, but the yeast associated with the overripe and decaying of organic matter. And so we find all kinds of crazy scenarios where, you know, there's just some, you know, half a crushed apple on the bottom of a garbage can that just nobody's thinking about, and it's got the right conditions. It needs some moisture. It can't be dry, but it has to be overly ripe, or we call them vinegar flies, to be honest. Fruit flies to an entomologist is a whole different group of creatures that would attack, you know, apples out in the field. But vinegar fly, to me, is very suggestive of the kind of scenario, because whatever is overly ripe often has kind of a vinegary or acetic acid smell to it. And so the same thing, you know, they're attracted to your bananas because the volatiles coming off the bananas get it. But the bananas that are sitting in the kitchen, a dishware, aren't ripe enough. It's, you know, they got to be black and just falling apart to be the real breeding site. And so we worry about, you know, washing out cans, you know, that have sugar syrup and those kind of things. I tell the story, and this goes back way back when my kids were small, of we were finding them in the basement, and I'm cruising around, and what it turned out to be was one of the few times in their life they got Kool-Aid, sugared Kool-Aid. they'd left a little paper cup. And as that started to evaporate, it got kind of a nice sugary slime, and be darned, that's where the fruit flies were breeding. And so it does take, as I said, but it's always a source that you've got to hunt down the source and get it cleaned up. So think of organic matter, think of moisture, and then, again, things that are starting to get overly ripe in early parts of decay. They don't get into real far decayed stuff, but early parts of decay.
Okay, terrific. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Kathy emailed us and wondered if you can talk about head lice. They seem to make their way into homes in the winter. How long from egg to adult, and would using a flat iron with a high heat setting kill them?
Okay. Head lice are basically something that has to stay on its host, which is people. The eggs are laid on the hairs. They're literally glued there. And then they'll usually hatch in a matter of 4 to 5 days. We get a lot of influx of head lice when the kids go back to school just because of the interaction of children who have not, you know.
Yeah.
And so it's quite common. I expect most of my calls coming in from September on through October. One of the problems that we've been having in the last decade or more is that some of the products don't work very well because of resistance. I knew we were heading the wrong direction when I had a mom who was a nurse. So I knew she was following the directions, and she talked about treating her children and just not, you know, the next day you're finding live head lice. That should not be. I have been a big proponent of some of the oil treatments like olive oil and the like. You know, there's some stuff on the internet that isn't quite as high on this treatment. But boy, when I've worked with people, I found leaving olive oil on the hair for about 8 to 9 hours is extremely effective and easy to work with. One would suggest, and this is really with many treatments, it probably helps to do a follow-up treatment about 10 days later, just in case. The eggs are harder to kill. And oil will kill the eggs, but that's the one weakness of olive oil, is that you do get potentially a little bit of survival. The reason you treat 10 days later is the eggs have hatched. They are in a more susceptible stage, and they are not old enough to mature to lay new eggs. And so you prevent, you know, further breeding. Hot irons, probably individually, if you touched a louse, yes. But I just wonder if you can get to all the nooks and crannies, you know, and the lice can move a little bit when you're going through the hair. And so, as I said, I think these head topical treatments are the best way. You know, you worry about other things like hats and combs. Those should be washed, or in some cases in the hat, you can freeze them, because head lice don't do well in cold environments. You know, wash pillows. But other than that, you know, people talk about taking toys and bagging them for a month and whatnot. And boy, you just, you know, a head louse out in the middle of your bedroom floor, 2 days at best it's going to live. I mean, it's just too cold and too dry. That's not a good habitat. And so I don't worry. And again, eggs typically don't come off the hair. I mean, they're glued on there. It's amazing how that glue is. And we call them nits is the official name for them. So as I said, I would consider, if we've had problems, consider some of these natural oil treatments, or you can attempt to use the stuff at the pharmacy. That's fine, but just keep your guard up and make sure you check real closely that they don't get past you, because we do have that problem.
Jack in Madison, on to you. Hi, Jack.
Hi. I have two things. One of them is I have these tiny flies. They're different than fruit flies because they move really fast. And they, like, dart for the eyes. And they seem to collect on my windowsill, but they don't mess with my plants or anything, and I don't know where they're coming from.
Okay. That's the case, Jack. If you can get me a critter, you know, get me a sample, just mail it in. The address at the lab is 1630 Linden Drive, Madison, and the university zip is 53706, because I just need to see them. If I need to see them, I think I can point you in the direction, but it just isn't. You know, I got a couple possibilities, but they're kind of long shots. You know, we do have, aside from fruit flies, we have aphids on plants. We have something called a forid fly that breeds in organic matter. We've got drain flies. And I've seen a couple other crazy things in my career. So as I said, if you can get, it doesn't have to be live, but get me a decent enough sample I can throw under the microscope, I can give you a better answer. Or the other option, if they sound like they're too small to do, but if you can take a decent digital picture of them, enough for me to, you know, get some feel of what they look like, I can probably give you an answer too.
All right.
And yeah, I'll just send you some samples of them.
Sounds good.
Thanks a lot for calling, Jack. Appreciate it. And Emily in Eau Claire. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a random question. I worked as a camp counselor this past summer. And the kids found in the middle of the woods, it looks like a wasp, but almost bigger than a wasp, like a mini dragon almost, probably about 5 inches long. It had this thing that came up around almost like a stinger, and then it had giant wings. I don't know if you could pinpoint that for me.
The critter is officially Megarissa, and probably the species Lunator. What it is a parasitic wasp of wood-boring creatures that we call wood wasps. And it uses this very long stinger to go 2 to 3 inches deep into the wood to lay its egg so that its larva can be a parasite of these creatures that are in the dead stumps and the like. And so they're very scary looking. Of course, this was the female.
Yeah.
And the males, which are really quite rare, don't have that long ovipositor, or what we call egg-laying device. So I said, very scary looking, and they're so characteristic, both because of their size. I mean, we have smaller versions of these. They belong to a family we call the ichneumonids, which are all parasitic wasps. We have hundreds of species in the state. You would argue that they're all beneficial. None of them are stinging wasps. They're all parasites of everything from spiders to all kinds of other insects. And as I said, but this one is specialized on some of the horntails and other creatures that we find in dead trees and rotting stumps.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And Bill in Dowling Lake, we are on to you now. Hi, Bill.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you. In the fall, after it gets cold, then on a warm day, in the ash, say like an ash wood pile, there will be a small, very delicate little fly with like a white feathery hairs coming off its abdomen and a, like a beautiful purplish-blue color to it.
Mm-hmm.
And they float. They're so fragile, they don't make headway flying. They just kind of drift in the breeze. The only time they show up is in a warm, sunny afternoon in the fall that I've ever seen them.
Okay, so it belongs to a group that we would call woolly aphids. I'm not so sure. I don't know of any on ash, but we've got them on alder and maple and a bunch of other things. And sometimes what you're seeing them is just kind of cruising or blowing through. And so it's a typical aphid, but what it does is it secretes this white waxy substance that reminds me of cotton candy. And some of them have filaments upwards of an inch long or so, which, you know, so they look like little moving fuzz balls. I mean, they're very beautiful when you get them up. Mm-hmm. You know, microscopically, and it's quite common for many aphids to move on to woody host plants in the late fall to lay their eggs, and that's how it gets through the winter. They hatch in the spring, go through some cycles, and I mean, many of these things have quite complicated life cycles. They need two different plants at different times of the year, and they're flying back and forth. But your description, it's got to be a woolly aphid. It's just a question of which species is involved, and again, they're very impressive little animals if you ever get a chance. And as I said, that's a fun one to look on the internet, because if you get a close-up of it, you'll see what I mean about these waxy filaments that come off the abdomen.
Absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah.
And so delicate, so incredibly delicate. But
yeah.
Thank you very, very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Bill, for calling. And Paul and Toma, it's your turn. Hi, Paul.
Yes, good morning. I listen to Wisconsin Public Radio all the time, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
What we got going on here is we have these sewer flies, and it's not just our resident, but it's the resident next door. They also have them. We tried putting bleach down the drains, and it's not, you know, it's not taking care of them.
Are you in an apartment or a single-family home or...?
It's a duplex.
Duplex, okay.
And it's just these two, this duplex, I don't know if they're, you know, if they're experiencing the same situation down the street, but what can we do about it?
Okay, well, you know, whether it is the moth or drain fly or the forward fly, which both sometimes are referred to as sewer flies, the source is very similar. And again, I go back to bleach doesn't do much with insects. We use bleach on the outer skin of an insect to basically get rid of all kinds of contaminants when we're doing experiments, and they survive it just fine. What I would suggest is you somehow have a buildup in the drains of organic matter. And so the secret is getting rid of that. And we talked earlier that, you know, sometimes just it's easy as a hot pail of water, but sometimes it's really more involved when that it's so thick and goopy that the water doesn't wash it away. So what you look for there are bacterial digesters. It's basically, you know, a substance that you mix and put into the drain, and it eats away at that organic matter. And it's not something that works overnight, but usually in a matter of 5 or 6 days, it will eat through all that goop, and then it flushes out, and then you're okay. So if that is the source, and this is where it gets a little tricky, is, you know, it's got to be organic matter, and it's got to have some moisture. You know, if it was dried up stuff, the sewer flies wouldn't breed. What I've seen people do sometimes is they will get a piece of saran wrap or other kinds of material and put it over the drain just for a night and see if any flies are caught coming up through the drain. Sometimes, though, it gets more complicated. I will tell you, I have seen cases where we have a broken drain pipe and all this organic matter is seeping underneath the slab of the basement.
Ugh.
And then if you put the drain cleaner, it's not where the source is. Again, it's leaking. In those cases, you literally got to get somebody in with a scope and to scope the drain to see if there's a broken line, and that has to be addressed. So that's the worst-case scenario. But for now, as I said, I would look at putting some bacterial digester down.
Or maybe boiling water first?
Yeah, boiling water first. But, you know, in the bacterial digesters, usually you can get it at the hardware store, you know, the big discount stores in the plumbing section. And as I said, not so much Drano. Because Drano is more of a caustic chemical. Here we have literally a biological organism that is feeding on that organic matter and thereby decomposing it and, as I said, loosening it up so it can get flushed down the drain.
What about like muriatic acid or something like that?
No. As I said, I my experience with it, if it's that big of a source, I need something that's going to eat through this and digest it rather than going with something that's caustic.
Okay.
All right. Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling, Paul. And Ron in Evergreen, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Ron.
Hi, good morning, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
A couple years ago, I was doing some yard work, and I disturbed a bee's nest in some brush. And I got stung in the ear. A couple days later, I went back out there. I disturbed the brush in the nest again. I got stung right underneath the eye. The third time, I got stung in the white of the eye. And I'm wondering if the bees are clever enough where they target the eyes to kind of disable their predators.
Sure. I've not heard that. What I have heard is some people feel that bees have sensors that react to heat. And if you think about it, a lot of times when we're out working, you know, you got shirts and stuff on. In one of the hottest parts of your body is your head. Forehead in particular, you know, is generating a lot of heat. And that's what they seem to react to. And movement, too, plays into it. But as I said, I think they're just drawn to the head because it's a hotter source. And, of course, it's very effective on their part.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And, Ron, after the third time, I would have been kind of thinking about trying a different approach there to getting into that brush. I might have been putting something over my head.
Well, it gets tough. You know, again, they're very defensive when the nest is disturbed and they do get agitated. And so a lot of times you're better to step back, see where the nest is, so it can be marked and dealt with down the line. So.
Lou and Madison, your turn. Hi, Lou.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This may be out of your area of expertise, but I thought I'd give it a shot. This is actually a tropical insect question from a recent vacation.
Okay.
The entire family went to the Caribbean, and we were plagued by these tiny little bites. We believed there were sand flies.
Mm-hmm.
After doing a bit of research, we discovered that these don't go away very quickly and could even cause some sort of lethal disease carrier, although the incidence is somewhat rare. I just wanted to know, how long these bites stay around, and B, really what is the chance of getting something a little bit more serious from these.
Okay. I mean, this fits into a group that we sometimes refer to as no-see-ums, and unfortunately that name's a little bit deceiving because they are very small gnats. They're associated usually with, again, water and organic matter. So they're kind of related to mosquitoes, but they're kind of not because instead of sucking the blood, it's kind of a multiple stabbing they do. This is what people often incorrectly refer to as sand fleas also. And the bites are often painless, but the reaction that you get of having itching and irritation and damaged tissue that lasts sometimes for 4, 5, 6 weeks afterwards is very classic. there are in places in the world where sand flies are capable of transmitting various human pathogens. Not so much in the Caribbean, more in Africa and elsewhere. Typically, I don't see a lot, and we don't see a lot of tropical disease issues come through here medically, but there are some possibilities, but the chance is very remote, especially where you are. Now, going back to the bite, it just takes time to heal. Again, you're having somewhat of an allergic reaction, and so, you know, sometimes surface creams that slow that down and whatnot are helpful. But as I said, I kind of expect it's something that will take at least 2 to 3 weeks to resolve, and maybe longer. That's just the way these bites react.
Well, thank you so much. It's mm-hmm. very helpful.
They're painful, that's for sure. They're really a bother until they finally go away. I know exactly what you're talking about. We have an insect identification question for you. This is a really cool insect.
It's a caterpillar. And the one thing...
Found in Washington Island in the middle of September.
Right. You see that there's these long, either black hairs. People would incorrectly sometimes think they're antennae, but these are what we call pencil hairs. There are both white and black ones on this species. Pencil hairs are quite characteristic of many of the tussock moths, and that's what I think this is.
Oh.
Although I will tell you there are some dagger moths. It's a different family of moths that also have these pencil hairs. And fuzzy caterpillars, many of them feed on broadleaf trees. In the most part, once in a great while, there's a couple tussock moths that get out of hand. But for most the most part, they're kind of innocent little caterpillars. And the moths are... nothing impressive, but that's the way moths are generally, is they're not very brightly colored. But so as I said, this is a tussock moth, and some of them do, they're related to the woolly bears. And so one of the things that you will see is that many of these caterpillars are out very late in the fall, don't spin their cocoons to the following spring, and then the moths emerge sometime in early summer.
Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I have another Facebook question or comment from Gina, Phil. So she went to the Larry Mueller Show and posted this question. She said, I was vacuuming under a bed upstairs, noticed some small maggot casing with no bugs inside, about six of them. What could have hatched under there?
What I see most often in this scenario is the capsules, or we call them puparium, which she called the maggot casing, are usually maybe about a quarter inch long in kind of a chestnutty brown color. And this comes from a group of creatures that include the blow and flesh flies. And one time or another, these things are always associated with dead animals, but if you had a mouse that died in the wall, it's something that may have not caught your attention. There may have been no odor associated with it. But when the maggots are done consuming it, they often migrate. And so I see them on the floor. And sometimes they're coming through light fixtures. You know, the critter died upstairs and they fall down, transform. And then the flies remind people of house flies. But in the case of the blowflies, they often are metallic-y, you know, greens and blues. In the case of the flesh flies, they're very bristly. Lots of dark, thick, black bristles on them.
Yeah.
And those are characteristic. And so, as I said, this may have been, if it was a very small source, which it sounds like, because there was no odor associated with it and there was very few maggots. I mean, if you had something as big as a squirrel, we could breed probably 300 to 500 flies minimum off of a carcass that size. I mean, they're very, really quite interesting. This is also the same group of insects we use for forensics when we're finding bodies and trying to figure time of death, that when we find the maggots, you know, because we know what their growth curves look like, we can kind of walk it back. And so it's a very interesting group. But in this case, it sounds like the flies have already come. That could have been 6 months ago. You know, it's hard to say. But that would be my guess, is they migrated from probably an animal source and they pupated under the bed and then the flies emerged.
Marion in Windsor, on to you now. Hi, Marion.
Hi. I have a question about houseplants. I previously have had some, I think it's spider mites. They had a little cottony stuff at the branches, where the leaf is onto the branch. And I did get rid of them through some spray that I'd gotten at Jung's Garden Center. But now, to prevent them, somebody said to keep them at bay or whatever, you could spray them with ordinary house hold soap and water, mm-hmm. and then it would get the dust off, too. And I'm wondering what suggestions you might have as the proportions and what kind
sure.
of soap.
Well, see, here's the problem. And this goes back to years ago on the show. We were talking about controlling box elder bugs, and my colleague from Iowa State said use a half a cup of Tide laundry detergent to a gallon of water, and people I told worked great. Well, a caller came in and said, I tried Cheer, and it didn't work.
Oh.
It turns out soap chemistries differ, and the product that they sell at the stores called insecticidal soap is the right stuff, and it contains no perfumes, no brighteners. When we start talking about home remedies, what I worry about, two things, is what concentration to use. I also worry about what exactly is in there, but sometimes we find some of the other added agents cause burns on the plant. So I think you're always taking a risk with home remedies versus buying the insecticidal soap. Now, the reality is if you have a very pure soap with no whiteners, brighteners, and the like, and you stay about 1% to 2% soap to water, that would be, if you go higher than that, the soaps often cause burns. So as I said, you can play around with home remedies, trying to stay with very pure detergents or soaps, but I think it's safer to buy the insecticidal soap. It's already diluted at the right stuff. It's at right concentration. It's got the right 18-carbon-long fatty acid, mm-hmm. potassium fatty acid, which is the best insect-killing soap that there is. It costs you a little bit more money. But the other side is I'm not a big proponent of treating the plants unless I start to see symptoms.
Yeah.
Now, it's okay if you bring plants in from the outside that, you know, in the fall that may have critters and you treat preventively there to prevent things from festering right away. But once you've got a clean plant, I think I'd leave it alone until I start to see critters again.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Nick in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Nick.
I've got a small problem. Actually, I don't have the problem. My wife's got the problem. I like spiders. I love them. I got no problem with them. My wife is deathly afraid. And for some reason, our house is just obsessed with them. I mean, I got my kids think it's great. They'll be like, look, Dad, there's a spider crawling across the ceiling. And of course, the wife doesn't exactly appreciate that. So I was wondering how to get rid of all these spiders.
Sure. Well, you know, I find, you know, spiders get a little tricky because they're good at hiding in places and the like. But honestly, a vacuum cleaner with an attachment that allows you to get back in the nooks and crannies, and in this case, it's well worth going down in the basement and going along the joists and the sill plates and whatnot, because that's often a place where a lot of the spiders are slowly breeding and then kind of coming up into your living space. The argument is that spiders have to eat insects, and so they're getting a good source of insects, which is much more likely in the basement than it is elsewhere. And so again, once every 6 months going in, it helps to have less clutter just because you can get to all the corners you need to. I find that as effective that any, you know, there are no magic sprays I know with spiders. And if you were to spray, you'd have to do the same thing as get back in all these nooks and crannies. And so, as I said, that would be one direction to go. Another thing that will help lessen it, they sell, we call them glue boards, and they're basically just cardboard with a very tacky material on it. And there are bigger versions that are used for catching mice and rats. But putting glue boards back in some of these places where the spiders are active, if they crawl on it, they get caught. This is most effective for hunting spiders, not so much the web spiders. And that would be a passive way of putting something up that would help lessen the numbers. The other thing, be careful that they're not migrating in from outside. You know, if they seem seasonal, spiders do that. And so then you're starting to talk about caulking and sealing around, you know, pipes and vents and other things so that spiders have a harder time getting in. So that combination should... You can't always, I don't expect you to get rid of them, but lessen the numbers such that your wife won't have as much a problem with critters crawling around.
All right. Thanks a lot for that call. You can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. Have open lines. We'll get you on pretty quickly. And Lenny in Green Bay, you're next. Hi, Lenny.
Hi. I'm calling about scabies.
Scabies?
Mm-hmm. Yes. My son got them about a month ago, and we finally took him to the doctor, and they gave him that 5% cream he put all over him, but he's still itching, and he's got all these bumps on his legs, and he looks like he's got these little welts on his the inside of his legs.
Okay, now a question: did they do a skin scraping when they gave you the material to treat it?
I'm not sure. He's 20 years old, and he's
sure.
Didn't tell me.
I will tell you that professionally, I get very frustrated in that the only way you can verify scabies is to do a skin scraping, and they look under the microscope and find the presence of the mites. I know what happens in some cases is people come in with symptoms that suggest scabies, and they get prescribed a material that is used to treat scabies. If the problem is not scabies, it doesn't solve it. And so, as I said, you know, there's always this question. If they said, yeah, we did the skin scraping, we knew it, well, then, you know, scabies do take, you have to follow the directions, you know, because they often get between the webs of your fingers and elsewhere. It gets a little tricky. But one of the things that's somewhat classic about scabies is you don't see typical bites. You see more trails and rashes are more the symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
So, as I said, I think it's well worth going back to the physician. And it's not working, and so we have to figure out, indeed, is this really still scabies, or do we have something else that's going on which needs a different treatment? And I will tell you, as I said, I probably hear 6 out of 10 times, 7 out of 10 times people get prescribed materials without doing the diagnostic test. And, you know, I know the physician, if we're right, we've solved the problem. If not, we go to the next step.
Yeah.
But this suggests to me you need to go to the next step.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Andrea in Madison, your turn. Hi, Andrea.
Hi there. How are you guys?
Great. Thanks for calling.
Got a question for you about ants in my house.
Okay.
Every year, about the same time, right around literally within a week of Valentine's Day, we get an onslaught of ants. We are on a slab, and our exterminators told us that, you know, there just must be some water under there. But he's actually baffled by it as well, that it happens every year. It's about the 5th year in a row.
Okay, what do the ants look like?
They're just little brown guys, the little walk-in-a-line ants.
Yeah, see, from my perspective, it would help to know which ant species it is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are a couple ants, and this is going to sound real crazy, but there's one ant that I see quite commonly in February and March, usually in the wing form. Tends to be a little bit more yellowish color, but they are kind of brownish, too. What I tell people is, what do they smell like? And they kind of roll their eyes. But honestly, this one is called a citronella ant, and it smells lemony. And it's an interesting ant because it often lives under slabs. And when the wing forms come out, these swarmers, and because the soil is warm because of the house, they think it's spring in February. So the timing would suggest that it's these ants. But there are other species involved. If there were other species involved, the strategy would be different, because most other species of ants we can bait. Citronella ants could care less about the baits we have, but they are usually a very short-term thing. And honestly, usually if you can find the crack in the slab or the expansion joint they're coming through and get it caulked, that itself would solve it. But I think the real answer is if we knew what kind of, which species of ant it was. And, you know, unfortunately, there's about 15 to 20 possibilities, you know, and that's where I'm handcuffed. If I knew which one it was, I could point you in the right direction. But the information you give me doesn't get me to a particular species.
Well, let me ask you this. How do you smell an ant?
To be honest, well, if there's a bunch of them in a jar, the odor's right there.
Oh, okay.
But
okay.
If it's only a couple of them, you crush it in your hand.
Okay.
Interesting enough, there is another ant called an odorous house ant, and it's supposed to smell like rotten coconut or kind of rancid butter. And some ants have no odor. So as I said, this is a test. Sometimes if it's just, boy, it smells nice, like lemon pledge, then I know I've got citronella ants and things are good. Because as I said, that's probably the least problematic ant. It's a very seasonal ant. It has no interest in people food, so it doesn't come in the kitchen. It just shows up every once in a while when it swarms. You could have pavement ants. You could have cornfield ants. Those are the two other ones I would think are possible. Pavement ants will live in your walls and stuff, and they're a little bit more frustrating to deal with than the other two.
Oh, my. All right.
All right, Andrea. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Appreciate the call. Sally in Middleton, hello to you.
Hello. Thank you so much for this opportunity. Last thing in my mind, but I heard you and appreciate your expertise, because I have an identification problem. It's a little bug that moves along on little bitty feet. It's a quarter of an inch only, and it's fat, and it looked like a seed, except it's a little fatter and maybe a little hairy. Very, very little hair. Very little legs. It's a cute little thing. I don't know where they come from. They're not in the food.
Okay. One of the things I'm thinking of, and again, the size, there's so many options, but the hairiness suggests it's a carpet beetle larvae. And although you do find carpet beetle larvae in food products, they also feed on animal hair, dead insects, bird feathers. And I will tell you, I can go to anybody's house, and if you let me scrounge around, I can find carpet beetles. They're there.
Really?
And although they once in a while will cause woolen damage, more of it is this kind of miscellaneous stuff, feeding on dead insects in the windowsill and the like. And so
they're only in the kitchen, strictly. Okay. Only in the kitchen.
I even found them an old mouse bait. I mean, there's lots of things. If you know, 10 years ago, somebody had a bag of peanuts fall behind a counter. To be honest, they could be feeding on that. And so there just is potentially enough food scraps. And again, if you have pets, you know, the animal hair that accumulates in out-of-the-way places. I don't get concerned unless I see numbers. I mean, if somebody says I'm seeing six a day, then I got a hot spot, you know, and then we got to search it down. But if you see one a month, as I said, I don't think there's really anything to worry about there.
I see two or three a day.
Okay, well, then there is a box of something or something. And, you know, they'll get into, you know, spices, potpourri. You know, so it's dry plant material, but because of this animal hair and other things, there are other places that they can come from. And I said, interesting enough, even if somebody ever used a Decon mouse bait, the grain base of that Decon, the warfarin in there doesn't affect insects. And
did
so
they
I find
to poison it or?
No. This is one that you got to hunt it down. I mean, spring is cosmetic. It doesn't get to the problem. If you can find what's infested and get it thrown out, they're gone.
There you go.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Our guest today, as we talk the wonderful world of insects here in Wisconsin and elsewhere, Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, heads up the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. With us until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, even with the colder temperatures, there's still lots of insect activity out there. And unfortunately, much of it has moved indoors. And sometimes it's hard to know what's cause for concern and what's maybe just an inconvenience. Hi, Larry Mueller here. So happy to have you along today on the Ideas Network. And we're lucky to have UW Extension Entomologist Phil Pelletieri with us until 12:30 to talk about the fascinating world of insects. He has lots of great information to share, and he'll answer your questions as well when you call at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, and don't forget to check our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show. I hope you can post your comments and your photos there. We've had some great photos already today. If you like the page while you're there, we'll send you updates on upcoming show topics. Stay tuned. We'll be back right after this quick look at the news. So happy to have you along here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist. And Phil, I don't know, you're on Friday of this week. If you're in the area, keep a lookout for a sleigh and some reindeer in the air, because Santa Claus is coming early to Wisconsin Public Radio, and he's landing on our roof at about 11:05, and he's going to come in and he'll be on my show from 11 until 12:30.
Can I leave a note for him about what he might bring me the next day?
You can leave a note. You can leave a note, but you can't call.
Okay.
Because you're too old. You can't call. It's only children can call on Friday. And so something we look forward to every year, and I bet he brings an elf with him, and Rudolph will be looking in the window. And so if those of you listening today, if you have a youngster or youngsters, oftentimes we'll talk to two or three children at the same house. I hope you'll have them call in. Most of the kids will be off by that time from school. And so 11 to 12:30 this Friday. It's one of my favorite shows of the year, actually. It's always a lot of fun. And Josh in Hayward, that's one of my favorite spots, too. I like Hayward an awful lot. And Josh is there right now, and he has a question for you. So let's go there. Hi, Josh.
Hey, guys. Always enjoy listening to this show.
Thank you.
I picked up a strange little hitchhiker here a couple of weeks ago. My nieces were up to visit, and we took our traditional little trip down to the river and did some fishing. And I was, I have a cold water fish tank at home, and I was trying to catch some minnows and, you know, whatever critters to put in the fish tank with the girls. And I was using a 5-gallon pail, and you kind of scoop along the shoreline where the grass overhangs into the river. And I caught some little bluegills and minnows and whatnot, and I caught a water bug, and I was explaining to them what that was and not to handle them because they can bite you if you make them mad. But anyways, so we took the stuff home and we dumped the little fishes in the tank. And after they had left, I was sorry they didn't get to see it. Clinging to the air, I got one of those little tube air diffusers on the side of the tank. Clinging to that was a what I would call an underwater walking stick. It's this elongated walking stick-looking bug, but it's obviously an aquatic bug, and I've never seen anything like it. And I've spent a lot of time snorkeling and, you know, wading in the swamps and whatnot. And
yeah, so it looks like a walking stick.
Sure.
It's a threatening-looking little guy. Oh, yeah. I don't know if he's harmful or not, but he's got like a barb on his rear end. He's an elongated thing. He's got long, it looks like he has four legs, but his front antennas may be legs. I'm not really
sure. It is. It's a critter called a water scorpion.
Yeah.
And they are predators in the water, and so they're related to the water bugs that you know about. You got to be careful because they'll nip you if you put your finger in front of them. And slow moving, and you know they're usually sitting in seaweed and other places and waiting for their prey to come back. So it's a do a search on water scorpion, and it is a true bug. It's a Hemipteran. That's the fam or order they belong to, but it's a unique family, and we've got a couple three species that you could bump into in the state.
Yeah, he's cool. If he stays in the fish tank, he or she, putting the fish flakes and the little dried shrimp and stuff in there, is that going to feed him?
No,
or
he's
what?
Probably going to need live prey, would be my guess. You know, so he, you know, they, I wouldn't put past if you had small enough minnows, but the minnows are probably too big for him to pick on. And typically it would feed on, you know, water boatmen and, you know, all kinds of other little critters you'd find in ponds and like.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Scott in Highland, on to you now. Hi, Scott.
Yes, my question is not so much how to get rid of an insect, but how to help it out.
Mm-hmm.
I have multiflora rose in my woods, and there's a mite that's carrying a fungus through the area that's helping take out the multiflora rose.
Sure.
And my question is, how can I assist that?
Okay. Well, two things. The disease that it causes is called rose rosette disease, and it is, honestly, I don't know if it's a virus or something virus-like. The mites are windblown, so they're spreading on their own. I will tell you that the success of the mites, they do a lot better in multiflora rose that are out in pastures in exposed places. They don't do very well in shaded areas. So if your woods is kind of heavily shaded, you may be disappointed, but well, all you need to do, if you see a plant that's infested with rosette disease, it starts to stunt and you get this brooming. You get all these shoots coming out of the end of it. And all you have to do is go and cut some of those brooms, bring them over to your plants, tie them on with a tie them or twist them. Right now, the mites are overwintering on the plant. So what you're doing is you're bringing the mites in, and then in the spring, they'll hatch out and go. And if it's a good environment, they will take hold. You already know that the mites are infected with the virus-like product because they've caused the disease. Typically, when it hits a multiflora rose, it's about a 2 or 3 year decline before it dies out.
Okay, yeah, and I've seen some of that, and I've done what you suggested. I just need to do more of it. And the multiflora rose was pretty thick in my woods, and it's starting to die back now. I would just like to...
Yeah, well, it'll spread on its own. I mean, that's the good news about it is once you got it introduced, it, I mean, unfortunately, it doesn't probably work as fast as we would like it to, but if you already got it introduced, but as I said, I think where you might find is, you know, stuff that's on the edge of the woods that gets quite a bit of sun will definitely be much more effective. And if stuff that's in heavy shade, the research tells us it just doesn't do very well in those environments.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. Anna Marie and Gillette, thank you for calling.
Yes, thanks for taking my call, and I appreciate having Phil Pelletieri on his expertise. What I'd like to ask is, where do vinegar bugs come from, and how is it that they just seemingly appear out of nowhere when you're working with juices or making homemade wine?
Yeah. Well, yeah, the homemade wine, I'm sure they're happy to be in your house. I mean, we have a number of native species of Drosophila or fruit flies. And so their chance of being brought in or flying in the fall is really quite high. And then once they get there, if they find the suitable stuff, they just kind of breed on their own. I mean, they turn a cycle every 2 weeks and the like. And you know, the frustrating thing sometimes is again, hunting down where this source is that keeps reinfesting things. And it you know, I've even seen them in rotting gladiola corms and other similar things. So sometimes it's just not what people think of as, you know, the overly ripe banana because I don't have fruit. Well, there are other things you can have in your house. And again, what it comes to is some moisture, some organic matter, and some form of overripeness or decay is exactly what fuels them.
And how long does it take them to, say, for instance, with my homemade wine, which I do make every year, how long does it take them to find out that you're working with the wine?
Once there's any kind of odor or whatnot coming off, it's attractant to them. I mean, that's what attracts them to all the fruit on the table is that, you know, they're getting the volatiles of the fruit. And as, of course, it's getting ripe, it's getting towards the conditions. That's what they would tend to lay their eggs on. And then 2 or 3 weeks later, if you allowed the fruit to stay there and decay, they would breed. But as I said, most often, none of us let our fruit sit that. Either we eat it up or we throw it out because it's, quote, rotten. And so that's why I find, even though you find them at one thing, the source is often something quite different. And as I said, that's when you worry about something spilling in a garbage can, you know, and not cleaning it out could honestly be the source that keeps fueling the whole system for you.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. We had Joe on our Facebook page says, got a way to get rid of fruit flies. They get an old coffee cup, put a couple tablespoons of vinegar in it. Then they cover it with saran wrap and a rubber band to keep it sealed, and then use a toothpick to poke 6 to 10 holes in the wrap, and then they just set the cup in the sink. And by morning, check and see how many flies you got.
You know, in basically inverted funnels, and you know, there's various trap designs. You can even buy some commercially, but if you think about it, you know, the design he has is kind of the same thing. You have a restricted access. They get in there, and they can't get out. The point would be is that does help to reduce the adult populations, but if you don't get at the source of the problem, it just keeps coming. As I said, you know, this does help, but ultimately, if they've still got a place to breed, you're going to have fruit flies every day, and you're going to have to put the trap out every day, and you might not catch up to them.
Here's Pam in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Hi, Pam. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just wondering, they're not ladybugs. They're the Chinese ladybugs. I don't know what they're called.
Asian lady beetles.
Yeah, we call them Asian lady beetles.
Okay, well, I still have them. I see one or two of them probably in a week, and I was wondering if there's any way I can get rid of them.
Okay, well, a couple things. These have been in our part of the Midwest for about the last 20 years or so. I will tell you that the problem is not even a tenth of what it was 10 years ago as far as numbers. But what it all comes down to is the ones you are seeing now snuck in a month to 6 weeks ago. And the problem is if they get in your walls or get in your attic, there's no way you quote, get them out. And when you get warm days, some wake up and come into your living space. I can assure you they're not breeding, but basically where you've got to draw the line is you stop them from getting in September by either sealing things up or there are sprays that can be put on the outside of the structure to stop them. But once they get in, you've lost the war until next fall.
I see. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Jackie in Sun Prairie, hello to you.
Hello. A few years ago, I want to tell you a story. Many years ago, actually, I was just a kid. Maybe I was 8 or 10 and living on a farm in northern Wisconsin. And we went out as kids. Mom shoved us out of the house. And had been cold, but there was very little snow. And we put, you know, our jackets on, boots on, and went out and clumped through the November, December, because it was getting toward Christmas, and we found these little ponds out in the pasture, and we lay down on them on our stomachs. I could still remember my bare tummy kind of getting onto the ice of the pond, and we looked down in there, and there was this whole little world we could see, and there were at least one water scorpion down there, and I had
I had seen these things, I think, before in this creek area. And so I wasn't too shocked about seeing that, but it was like a little world down inside of the ice. And I was delighted to hear that there, you know, that this was a water scorpion. I didn't know what the name of it was. But it reminded me of Henry David Thoreau and how he talked about going out on the pond and looking down into the pond and seeing all the critters down there and saying, heaven is under our feet. And I always think that is a kind of a warm Christmas or winter story, even though it was pretty cold on my belly. So, you know, it. But I'm delighted to hear what the name of that critter is. So thank you very much, and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you, Jackie. Yeah, those and it is fun to get a look under the
ice. You know, I think the people that appreciate the diversity that you've got in water are people that are trout fisher people or whatnot,
yeah.
Because there's just it's a whole different universe. It really is. The critters there you find nowhere else, and there literally are hundreds of species in Wisconsin in our creeks, rivers, lakes, and streams.
Donna in Spooner, on to you. Hi, Donna.
Yes. Hi. I have a question about wood ticks.
Okay.
Quite a few. Are they out all year? Does the insect repellent work on them? And I understand there's two types. And the reason I'm asking is that I live up in Spooner, and I've known personally five people that have been getting this ehrlichiosis from the ticks. And I don't think a lot of people know about it, and I don't think they're going to the doctor soon enough. And have these diseases always been carried by these ticks, and we just didn't know about it all these years? Or?
Okay, a couple parts of the story. We have both wood ticks and deer ticks in the state. The tick that's spreading the disease is the deer tick. There are four diseases that they can give you. Lyme disease, ehrlichiosis, there's an anaplasmosis, and there's a babesiosis. So four diseases. These are all mouse diseases that the tick picks up when it's feeding on the mice, and then if it feeds on a person, it transmits the disease. And so it's a bridge if you think about it that way.
Okay.
The difference about the deer tick is that it is out there anytime there's no snow on the ground. I even got an email 2 days ago. Somebody was out walking their dog, and they said, "You were right." And I said, "I know. I mean, we see this, that you've got to keep your guard up." Whereas those of us who grew up in the state, you know, the deer tick has been basically a phenomenon the last three decades.
Okay.
And the wood ticks that we all see in the spring have not been shown scientifically to transmit these diseases. They are capable of transmitting Rocky Mountain spotted fever, but we've only had like four cases in the last 30 years in the state, so that's pretty much a non-issue. But the wood ticks are most active in the spring up until about the 1st of July, and then they become few and far between. But as I said, this deer tick, and what we're seeing with the deer tick, although it's started up in your neck of the woods, the first one was recorded out of Spooner back in 69 by one of Dr. DeFoyart's students. They continue to move, and we're seeing more activity now on the east side of the state, which is relatively new. And, you know, the cases of Lyme disease, we had a 35% increase this past year, or not for 2010. You know, that's been on the increase. We've had well over 3,500 cases in the state. But anaplasmosis, there was almost 400 in some cases recorded. So all these are becoming more prevalent as the tick becomes more widespread, and we see a higher percentage of the ticks carrying the disease.
Well, these people have been really, really sick. I mean, like we're talking 6 months where they're not feeling well. Gosh.
Yeah. Well, you know, you get these infections, and they're hard to clear up. And the repellents do work. What I think is the best of the repellents is not so much a skin treatment, which is the DEET products, but the clothing treatments, which is permethrin-based. The reason I say that is permethrin is not a repellent, it's a killer. And so if you spray your clothing and the ticks walk on it, they will die before they have the opportunity to transmit the disease. And so if you're an outdoor person, they even sell clothing that has this impregnated. I mean, if you really, you know, you work cutting trees and whatnot all summer long, then it may be worth looking into some of those things for personal protection.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Donna. Marcus in Green Bay, hi there to you.
Hello. About 40-plus years ago when I was a kid, I was growing up in a residential Green Bay, and in the backyard when it would flood, I think during spring, but maybe it was just summer rains, there'd be these little ponds in the grass, and in the little ponds or puddles, there would be these transparent-looking little fish-type things, but, you know, I'm thinking they might have been insects, and they were just all kind of gills of what they were, and they just kind of float around real delicate, and you could see two black eyes. And we used to, I
think we used to call them paramecians, but what the heck were those things? And I've never seen any since, and I'm always out looking around and stuff in the woods.
I mean, there are some insects that would fit because some of the aquatic insects have gills, but there's other kinds of arthropods that you find. You know, there's fairy shrimp and the like. I mean, there's a whole different world there. And so, you know, I know it's some arthropod of one sort or another, but exactly which one without seeing it. And, you know, we have to count the number of legs and the like. But look up fairy shrimp sometime. That kind of fits what you have. And they're quite interesting because their eggs can kind of stay dormant till things reflood and they transform pretty quickly. So that would be one guess, but there are definitely some other possibilities.
Well, thanks. I'll look it up.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Rod in Weyerhauser, your turn. Hi, Rod.
Yeah, hello there. Thanks again for taking the call.
Sure.
Two quick questions. She was talking about scorpions. My dad said years ago, clearing land when they were blowing stumps and that. Well, anyhow, in the stump, he said, his brother, he said, but that is a scorpion, he says, you know, and my dad said, he looked at that thing, he says, well, I don't know if it was an insect or a scorpion, so I'm just wondering if there is some kind of a scorpion around here. And also, I caught a lot in the woods, and these spiders, and you never find just one. It's like I cut some oak, you know, dead oak down or something for firewood, and popple too, and you'll see them, and the suckers are big, and hairy, their leg spreads the top of a pop can, and their abdomen is like the pole tab.
Okay.
I just got looking at that.
Sure.
So
they're probably wolf spiders, and wolf spiders like to hide in places during the day and then go out and cruise for food at night. And there's also a fishing spider, which is a big spider that's very similar. And you can find fishing spiders quite a ways away from water. So I bet you it's one of those two in particular. Again, the first question was...
Yeah, those spiders, they're not poisonous. I mean, but there's always a bunch of them, and they're up high in the trees.
Yeah, well, they go out hunting. I mean, they're out looking for food, and they will crawl all around, and occasionally, once in a while, they'll crawl in a house and kind of freak people out, but a house is not the place that they want to live in. But you had a question earlier than that?
Years ago when they were busting lambs and blowing dynamite.
Oh, the scorpion. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
The scorpion.
The closest that we have any native North American scorpions is about Kentucky. So you have to go south of there. I have seen scorpions come in on produce and other things, but we don't have any native scorpions in Wisconsin.
There you go. Thank you for calling. And Judy in Superior, it is your turn. Hi, Judy.
Hi. Actually, it's Jody, but I've been called worse.
Okay. Thanks, Jody.
I apologize if you've already addressed this earlier in the show, but I just turned the radio on and heard you talking about the deer ticks with Lyme's disease. Earlier in the summer, I had been out for a walk in the woods and walked through a nest of wood ticks, and it was probably about 2 hours before I realized I had over 20 wood ticks on me. And about six of them were stuck, and one of them was a real small one.
Mm-hmm.
And we pulled it off, and the following day I had a rash where that wood tick had been. And I went to urgent care thinking it was Lyme's disease, and he said that the wood tick has to be on, or the deer tick has to be on, for over 24 hours. To transmit the Lyme's disease?
Yes.
And I had never heard that before, but is that the case?
Yeah, 24 to maybe as long as 36 hours. And the reason is that the deer tick, the first few hours, is not feeding on you, but is literally burrowing that mouth part in, and it glues it in. And this process takes time.
Oh, okay.
After that period of time, then it starts to suck your blood and pump saliva in, and that's when the transmission is. So that's why the directions for folks is, if you're out camping and you check the day of and you find ticks, there's nothing to worry about, you know, because you're removing the tick before it has the opportunity. Oftentimes when people tell me they have ticks, I ask them to send it to me, and that's what I'm looking at. I can often tell by how much the abdomen is swollen if it was feeding or not, and that's significant because, again, if you know it's a short period of time, no worry. The reaction you got was just a localized reaction to this salivary component. So you'll see, I've had deer ticks on me for 3 or 4 days, and you swear that I tried to push a pencil into my skin 2 inches deep because it's a very significant bruise.
Yeah.
That's not the symptom of Lyme disease. It's more of a surface rash, and they'll talk about it being, sometimes it's bullseye-like, clear in the center, but it's often 3 to 4 to 5 inches or more. And so it's significant.
Yeah.
But other times it presents like a heat rash. And so it can be kind of subtle, but it's usually quite a bit of skin involvement, not that localized, you know, nickel-sized reaction around where the tick was biting.
There you go.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Phil, oh, my goodness. The time flew here.
Boy, lots of critters for a cold day.
Yeah. Lots of critters, and I see there's still more critters to deal with. Unfortunately, we don't have any more. We're out of time. And I'm sure that next year, in 2012, you will be back.
I will be here.
I'm really glad for that. Thanks so much, Phil, and Merry Christmas. Bill Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, heads up the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. And we've got a link to the diagnostic lab at my Facebook page. If you just want to go to the Larry Mueller Show, you can get that link right there. Tomorrow, oh, looking forward to this too, baking instructor Paul Novak will have some freshly baked bread for me and for you as well. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.